O'Malley, perhaps the oldest law firm in D.C., and certainly the stuffiest. A December wedding was planned at an Episcopal church in McLean, with a reception at the Potomac Country Club. In less than a month, she had found someone she loved enough to marry. Someone willing to stomach a life with Bennett and Barb. Someone with enough money to impress all the Van Horns. The phone rang again, and it was Paulette. "You okay?" she asked. "I'm fine," he said, trying hard. "I'm real sorry, Clay." It was over, Paulette. It had been unraveling for a year. This is a good thing. Now I can forget her completely. "You say so. I'm okay. Thanks for calling. When you coming home?" "Today. I'll be there in the morning." The office dress code had rapidly evolved into an anything-goes style. The tone was set by the boss, who leaned toward jeans and expensive T-shirts, with a sports coat nearby in case he went to lunch. He had designer suits for meetings and court appearances, but for the moment both of those were rare events, since the firm had no clients and no cases. Everyone had upgraded their wardrobes, much to his satisfaction. They met late Monday morning in the conference room. Paulette, Rodney, and a rather rough-looking Jonah. Though she had acquired considerable clout in the short history of the firm, Miss Glick was still just a secretary-slash-receptionist. "Folks, we have work to do," Clay began the meeting. He introduced them to Dyloft, and relying on Pace's concise summaries, gave a description and history of the drug. "As of today, no lawsuit has been filed, but we're about to change that. On July the 2nd, we start the war by filing a class action here in D.C. on behalf of all patients harmed by the drug. It will create chaos, and we'll be right in the middle of it." "Do we have any of these clients?" Paulette asked. "Not yet, but we have names and addresses. We start signing them up today. We'll develop a plan for gathering clients, then you and Rodney will be in charge of implementing it. It'll cost at least $2 million. "This firm has $2 million, Jonah blurted, saying what everyone else was thinking. "It does. We start working on the ads today." "How many clients are we looking at?" Rodney asked. "Thousands, it's hard to say." Rodney pointed at each of them, slowly counting to four. "According to my numbers," he said, "there are four of us. We're adding more. Jonah is in charge of expansion. We'll lease some space out in the suburbs and fill it with paralegals. They'll work the phones and organize the files." "Where does one find paralegals?" Jonah asked. "In the employment sections of the bar journals. Start working on the ads, and you've got a meeting this afternoon with a real estate agent out in Manassas. We'll need about 10,000 square feet, nothing fancy, but plenty of wiring for phones and a complete computer system, which, as we know, is your specialty. Lease it, wire it, staff it, then organize it. The sooner the better." "Yes, sir." "How much is a Dyloft case worth?" Paulette asked. He did the math for them, lowballing everything. There was silence when he finished. "That's $10 million in fees," she said slowly. "All to this firm?" "Yes. And we're going to share the fees." The word "share" echoed around the room for a few seconds. Jonah and Rodney glanced at Paulette, as if to say, "Go ahead, finish it off." "Share in what way?" she asked, very deliberately. 10% to each of you." "So in my hypothetical, my share of the Dyloft fees would be $1 million?
"That's correct."
"And, same for me?" Rodney asked. "Same for you, same for Jonah, and I must say, I think that's on the low side." Low side or not, they absorbed the numbers in muted silence for what seemed like a very long time, each instinctively spending some of the money. For Rodney, it meant college for the kids. For Paulette, it meant a divorce from the Greek she'd seen once in the past year. For Jonah, it meant life on a sailboat.
"You're serious, aren't you, Clay?" Jonah asked.
"Dead serious. If we work our butts off for the next year, there's a good chance we'll have the option of an early retirement."
"Who told you about this Dyloft?" Rodney asked.
"I can never answer that question, Rodney. Sorry, just trust me." And Clay hoped at that moment that his blind trust in Max Pace was not foolish.
"I almost forgot about Paris," Paulette said. "Don't. We'll be there next week." On the third floor of his townhouse, Clay had put together a small office. Not that he planned to do much work there, but he needed a place for his papers. The desk was an old butcher block he'd found in an antique store in Fredericksburg, just down the road. It consumed one wall and was long enough for a phone, a fax, and a laptop. It was there that he made his first tentative entry into the world of mass tort solicitation. He delayed the call until almost 9 p.m., an hour at which some folks went to bed, especially older ones and perhaps those afflicted with arthritis. A stiff drink for courage, and he punched the numbers. The phone was answered on the other end by a woman, perhaps Mrs. Ted Worley of Upper Marlboro, Maryland. Clay introduced himself pleasantly, identified himself as a lawyer, as if they called all the time and there was nothing to be alarmed about, and asked to speak to Mr. Worley. Voices in the background as she yelled something to Ted, who yelled something back. Finally, he took the phone. "Who is this?" he demanded, and Clay quickly introduced himself. "Do I know you?" Mr. Worley asked. He was 70 years old. "No, sir, I'm an attorney here in D.C., and I specialize in lawsuits involving defective drugs. I sue drug companies all the time when they put out harmful products." "Okay, what do you want?" "Through our internet sources, we found your name as a potential user of an arthritis drug called Dyloft. Can you tell me if you use this drug?"
"Maybe I don't want to tell you what prescriptions I'm taking."
A perfectly valid point, one Clay thought he was ready for. "Of course you don't have to, Mr. Worley, but the only way to determine if you're entitled to a settlement is to tell me if you're using the drug."
"Well, yeah, I take Dyloft."
"For how long?"
"Maybe a year. It works great."
"Any side effects?"
"Such as?"
"Blood in your urine, a burning sensation when you urinate?" Clay was resigned to the fact that he would be discussing bladders and urine with many people in the months to come. There was simply no way around it.
"No. Why?"
"We have some preliminary research that Ackerman Labs, the company that makes Dyloft, is trying to cover up. The drug has been found to cause bladder tumors in some of the folks who use it." And so Mr. Ted Worley, who just moments earlier had been minding his own business, would now spend the rest of that night and most of the next week worrying about tumors growing wild in his bladder. Clay felt rotten and wanted to apologize, but he told himself that it had to be done. How else might Mr. Worley learn the truth? If the poor man indeed had the tumors, wouldn't he want to know about them? Holding the phone with one hand and rubbing his side with the other, Mr. Worley said,
"You know, come to think of it, I do remember a burning sensation a couple of days ago."
"What are you talking about?" Clay heard Mrs. Worley say in the background.
"If you don't mind," Mr. Worley said to Mrs. Worley.
Clay charged in before the bickering got out of hand. "My firm represents a lot of Dyloft users. I think you should consider getting tested."
"What kind of test?"
"It's a urinalysis. We have a doctor who can do it tomorrow. Won't cost you a dime."
"What if he finds something wrong?"
"Then we can discuss your options. When the news of Dyloft comes out in just a few days, there will be many lawsuits. My firm will be a leader in the attack on Ackerman Labs. I'd like to have you as a client."
"Maybe I should talk to my doctor."
"You can certainly do that, Mr. Worley, but he may have some liability, too. He prescribed the drug. It might be best if you get an unbiased opinion."
"Should I stop taking the drug?"
"Let's do the test first. Dyloft will likely be pulled off the market sometime this summer."
"Where do I do the test?"
"The doctor is in Chevy Chase. Can you go tomorrow?"
"Yeah, sure, why not? Seems silly to wait, doesn't it?"
2 days later, Clay pulled into the Worleys' driveway in Upper Marlboro and met them at the front door. The urinalysis, which included a cytological exam, revealed abnormal cells in the urine, a clear sign, according to Max Pace and his extensive and ill-gotten medical research, that there were tumors in the bladder. Mr. Worley had been referred to a urologist whom he would see the following week. The examination and removal of the tumors would be by cystoscopic surgery, running a tiny scope and a knife in a tube through the penis into the bladder, and while this was purported to be fairly routine, Mr. Worley saw nothing ordinary about it. He was worried sick. Mrs. Worley said he hadn't slept the last 2 nights, nor had she. As much as he wanted to, Clay could not tell them that the tumors were probably benign. Better to let the doctors do that after the surgery. Over instant coffee with powdered creamer, Clay explained the contract for his services and answered their questions about the litigation. When Ted Worley signed at the bottom, he became the first Dyloft plaintiff in the country. The Paris adventure cost him $95,300, according to the numbers so carefully kept by Rex Criddle, a man who was becoming more and more familiar with almost all aspects of Clay's life. Criddle was a CPA with a mid-sized accounting firm situated directly under the Carter suite. Not surprisingly, he too had been referred by Max Pace. At least once a week, Clay walked down the back stairs, or Criddle walked up them, and they spent a half an hour or so talking about Clay's money and how to properly handle it. An accounting system for the law firm was basic and easily installed. Miss Glick made all the entries and simply ran them down to Criddle's computers. In Criddle's opinion, such sudden wealth would almost certainly trigger an audit by the Internal Revenue Service. Notwithstanding Pace's promises to the contrary, Clay agreed and insisted on perfect records with no gray areas when it came to write-offs and deductions. He had just earned more money than he'd ever dreamed of. No sense trying to beat the government out of some taxes. Pay them and sleep well. Criddle studied a printout for a moment, a dozen questions clicking through the calculator behind his glasses. "Could I ask why you need 6 more paralegals when you have so few cases?" "Now, that's an interesting question," Clay said. He blitzed through the pending class action without mentioning either the drug or its maker, and if his quick summary answered Criddle's questions, it wasn't obvious. As an accountant, he was naturally skeptical of any scheme that urged more people to sue. "I'm sure you know what you're doing," he said, suspecting Clay had, in fact, lost his mind. "Trust me, Rex, the money is about to pour in." "It's certainly pouring out. You have to spend money to make money." "That's what they say." The assault began just after sundown on July 1st. With everyone but Miss Glick gathered in front of the television in the conference room, they waited until exactly 8:32 p.m., then grew quiet and still. It was a 15-second ad that began with a shot of a handsome young actor wearing a white jacket and holding a thick book and looking sincerely at the camera. "Attention, arthritis sufferers. If you are taking the prescription drug Diloft, you may have a claim against the manufacturer of the drug. Diloft has been linked to several side effects, including tumors in the bladder." On the bottom of the screen, the bold words, "Diloft Hotline, call 1-800-555-DYLO, appeared. The doctor continued, "Call this number immediately. The Diloft Hotline can arrange a free medical test for you. Call now." "Pretty nasty," said Rodney, who'd seen the video of the ad a dozen times. Still, it was much harsher on real television. "It'll work," Clay said, ever the leader. For the first hour, it ran on stations in 30 markets along the East Coast. Then it spread to 18 markets in the Central Time Zone. 4 hours after it began, it finally reached the other coast and hit in 42 markets. Clay's little firm spent just over $400,000 the first night in wall-to-wall advertising. The 800 phone number routed callers to the sweatshop, the new nickname for the shopping center branch of the law offices of J. Clay Carter II. There, the 6 new paralegals took the calls, filled out forms, asked all the scripted questions, referred the callers to the Diloft Hotline website, and promised return calls from one of their staff attorneys. Within 2 hours of the first ads, all phones were busy. A computer recorded the numbers of those callers unable to get through. A computerized message referred them to the website. At 9 the next morning, Clay received an urgent phone call from an attorney in a large firm down the street. He represented Ackerman Labs and insisted that the ads be stopped immediately. He was pompous and condescending and threatened all manner of vile legal action if Clay did not buckle immediately. Words grew harsh, then calmed somewhat. "Are you going to be in your office for a few minutes?" Clay asked. "Yes, of course. Why?" "I have something to send over. I'll get my courier. It should take 5 minutes."
Rodney, the courier, hustled down the street with a copy of the 20-page lawsuit.
Clay left for the courthouse to file the original. Pursuant to Pace's instructions, copies were also being faxed to the Washington Post, the Wall Street Journal, and the New York Times. Pace had also hinted that short-selling Ackerman Lab stock would be a shrewd investment move. The stock had closed the Friday before at $42.50. When it opened Monday morning, Clay placed a sell order for 100,000 shares. He'd buy it back in a few days, hopefully around $30, and pick up another $1 million. That was the plan, anyway. His office was hectic when he returned. There were 6 incoming toll-free lines to the sweatshop out in Manassas, and during working hours, when all 6 were busy, the calls were routed to the main office on Connecticut Avenue. Rodney, Paulette, and Jonah were each on the phone talking to Diloft users scattered around North America.
"You might want to see this," Miss Glick said.
The pink message slip listed the name of a reporter from the Wall Street Journal.
And Mr. Pace is in your office.
Max was holding a coffee cup and standing in front of a window. It's filed, Clay said. We've stirred up a hornet's nest.
Enjoy the moment.
Their lawyers have already called. I sent them a copy of the lawsuit.
Good. They're dying already. They've just been ambushed and they know they'll get slaughtered. This is a lawyer's dream, Clay. Make the most of it.
Sit down. I have a question.
Pace, in black as always, fell into a chair and crossed his legs. The cowboy boots appeared to be of rattlesnake.
How much cash can Ackerman afford? Clay asked.
They're insured for at least $300 million. Plus they have about $500 million in cash, most of it generated by Dyloft. They're almost maxed out at the bank, but if I were calling the shots, I'd plan on paying $1 billion. And I would do it fast.
Will Ackerman do it fast?
They haven't hired me, so they're not too bright. I've watched the company for a long time, and they're not particularly sharp. Like all drug makers, they're horrified at litigation. Instead of using a fireman like me, they do it the old-fashioned way. They rely on their lawyers, who, of course, have no interest in quick settlements. The principal firm is Walker Stearns in New York. Walker Stearns will put 50 associates on the case with meters churning at full blast. Mr. Worley's class action is worth $100 million to Ackerman's own lawyers. Don't ever forget that.
Why don't they just pay me $100 million to go away?
Now you're thinking like a real mass tort boy. They'll pay you even more, but first they have to pay their lawyers. That's just the way it works.
Miss Glick appeared in the door and said, "That reporter from the Wall Street Journal is on the phone again."
Clay looked at Pace, who said, "Chat him up. And remember, the other side has an entire PR unit cranking out the spin."
The Times and the Post ran brief stories of the Dyloft class action on the front pages of their business sections the following morning. Both mentioned Clay's name, which was a thrill he quietly relished. The Wall Street Journal got it right, at least in Clay's opinion. In the preliminaries, the reporter had asked Clay his age.
"Only 31, he'd said,
which led to a series of questions about Clay's experience, his firm, etc. David versus Goliath is much more readable than dry financial data or lab reports, and the story took on a life of its own. A photographer was rushed over, and while Clay posed, his staff watched with great amusement. On the front page, far-left column, the headline read, "The Rookie Takes on Mighty Ackerman Labs." Beside it was a computerized caricature of a smiling Clay Carter. The first paragraph read, "Less than 2 months ago, D.C. attorney Clay Carter was laboring through the city's criminal justice system as an unknown and low-paid public defender. Yesterday, as the owner of his own law firm, he filed a $1 billion lawsuit against the third largest pharmaceutical company in the world, claiming its newest wonder drug, Dyloft, not only relieves acute pain for arthritis sufferers, but also causes tumors in their bladders."
"Make sure this gets on the website," Clay said as he handed the article to Jonah. "Our clients will love it."
Tequila Watson pleaded guilty to the murder of Ramon Pumphrey and was sentenced to life in prison. He would be eligible for parole in 20 years, though the story in the Post did not mention that. Clay made a note to call Adelpha and see how her life was going. He owed something to Tequila, but he wasn't sure what. Nor was there any way of compensating his ex-client. He rationalized that he had spent most of his life on drugs and would probably spend the rest behind bars anyway, with or without Tarvan. But this did little to make Clay feel honorable. He had sold out, plain and simple. He'd taken the cash and buried the truth. Miss Glick handed him the phone message as he walked by her desk. He looked at the name twice and was still skeptical when he sat in the conference room and punched the numbers. "Mr. Patton French," he said, into the phone. "And who's calling, please?"
"Clay Carter from D.C.
"Oh, yes, he's been expecting you." The image of such a powerful and busy lawyer as Patton French waiting for Clay's phone call was difficult to imagine. Within seconds, the great man himself was on the phone.
"Hello, Clay. Thanks for calling me back," he said so casually Clay was caught off guard. "Nice story in the Journal, huh? Not bad for a rookie. Look, sorry I didn't get to say hello when you were down in New Orleans."
It was the same voice he'd heard from behind the microphone, but much more relaxed.
"I'd like to meet you, Clay," French went on. "I think we can do some business together. I was on the Dyloft trail 2 months ago. You beat me to the punch, but there's a ton of money out there."
Clay had no desire to crawl into bed with Patton French. On the other hand, his methods of extracting huge settlements from drug companies were legendary.
"We can talk," Clay said.
Look, I'm headed to New York right now.
What if I pick you up in D.C. and take you with me?
I got a new Gulfstream 5 I'd love to show off. We'll stay in Manhattan, have a wonderful dinner tonight, talk business, back home late tomorrow. What do you say?
Well, I'm pretty busy.
I'll bet you are. Look, I'm busy too. Hell, we're all busy. But this could be the most profitable trip you'll ever make. I'm not taking no for an answer. I'll meet you at Reagan National in 3 hours. Deal?
The private terminal at Reagan National was packed with harried executives and bureaucrats hustling through, coming and going. Near the reception counter, a cute brunette in a short skirt held a handmade placard with his name on it. He introduced himself to her. She was Julia, with no last name.
"Follow me," she said with a perfect smile.
Cleared through an exit door and driven across the ramp in a courtesy van, they stopped beside the largest jet in sight.
"That's us," Julia said, and they got out of the van.
A pilot grabbed Clay's overnight bag and disappeared with it. Patton French was, of course, on the phone. He waved Clay aboard while Julia took his jacket and asked him what he wanted to drink. "Just water with lemon." His first view inside a private jet could not have been more breathtaking. A minute later, Julia served him his water.
"Better have a seat," she said. "We're about to taxi."
When the plane began moving, French abruptly ended his conversation and charged forward. He attacked Clay with a violent handshake and toothy smile and another apology for not getting together down in New Orleans. He was a bit heavy, graying nicely with thick, wavy hair, probably 55 but not yet 60. Vigor oozed from every pore and breath. They sat across from each other at one of the tables.
"Nice ride, huh?" French said, waving his left arm at the interior. "You got a jet yet?"
"No."
"It won't be long, son. You can't live without one. Julia, get me a vodka. She's cute, huh?"
"She is."
"Lots of overhead, but then there's lots of fees out there. Did you hear me speak in New Orleans?"
"I did. It was very enjoyable."
Clay lied a little.
"I hate to dwell on money like that, but I was playing to the crowd. Most of those guys will eventually bring me a big tort case. Gotta keep them pumped up, you know. I built the hottest mass tort firm in America, and all we do is go after the big boys. Their cash is endless. I'm just trying to level the field."
Julia brought his drink and strapped herself in for takeoff.
"You want some lunch?" French asked. "She can cook anything."
"No, thanks. I'm fine."
French took a long swig of the vodka, then suddenly sat back, closed his eyes, and appeared to be praying as the Gulfstream sped down the runway and lifted off. Minutes passed until they leveled off, then Julia disappeared into the kitchen. French snapped out of his meditation and took another gulp.
"I gotta tell you, Clay, this Dyloft ambush of yours is a thing of beauty, and very unusual. In most cases, it takes time for these bad drugs to get discovered. What you've done is very unique, which tells me that you have some inside information."
"I do," Clay smiled,
"and I'll never tell anybody."
"Good. That makes me feel better. I saw your ads. We monitor such things in every market. How many cases have you generated?"
"It's hard to say. They have to do the initial urinalysis. The phones have not stopped ringing."
Julia appeared with two platters of food, a shrimp tray and one covered with cheeses and various meats, prosciutto, salami, and several more Clay could not name.
"A bottle of that Chilean white," Patton said. "It should be chilled by now."
"Do you like wine?" he asked, grabbing a shrimp by its tail.
"Some. I'm no expert." "I adore wine. I keep 100 bottles on this airplane."
Another shrimp.
"Anyway, we figure there are between 50 and 100,000 Dyloft cases. That sound close?"
100 might be on the high side," Clay said cautiously.
"I'm a little worried about Ackerman Labs," French confessed. "Of course, they're not in danger of bankruptcy or anything like that, and they've got some insurance."
He was fishing here, and Clay decided to take the bait.
"They have at least $300 million in insurance," he said, "and perhaps a $500 million to spend on Dyloft."
French smiled and almost drooled over this information. He could not and did not try to hide his admiration.
"Great stuff, son. Wonderful stuff. How good is your inside dirt?"
"Excellent. We have insiders who'll spill the beans, and we have lab reports that we're not supposed to have. Ackerman cannot get near a jury with Dyloft."
"Awesome,"
French said as he closed his eyes and absorbed these words. A starving lawyer with his first decent car wreck could not have been happier. Julia was back with the wine, which he poured into two priceless small goblets. French sniffed it properly, and evaluated it slowly, and when he was satisfied, he took a sip. He smacked his lips and nodded his head, then leaned in for more gossip.
Let me trot out a scenario for you, Clay, and I promise you it is designed to get you more money in a shorter period of time. Much more.
I'm listening.
I'll end up with as many Dyloft cases as you. Now that you've opened the door, there will be hundreds of lawyers chasing these cases. We, you and I, can control the litigation if we move your lawsuit from D.C. to my backyard in Mississippi. That will terrify Ackerman Labs beyond anything you can imagine. They're worried now because you've nailed them in D.C., but they're also thinking, well, he's just a rookie, never been here before, never handled a mass tort case, this is his first class action, and so on. But if we put your cases with mine, combine everything into one class action, and move it to Mississippi, then Ackerman Labs will have one huge, massive corporate coronary.
Clay was almost dizzy with doubt and with questions.
I'm listening, was all he could manage. You keep your cases, I keep mine. We pool them, and as the other cases are signed up and the lawyers come on board, I'll go to the trial judge and ask him to appoint a plaintiff steering committee. Do it all the time. I'll be the chairman. You'll be on the committee because you filed first. We'll monitor the Dyloft litigation, try and keep things organized, though with a bunch of arrogant lawyers, it's hard as hell. I've done it dozens of times. The committee gives us control. We'll start negotiating with Ackerman pretty soon. I know they're lawyers. If your inside dope is as strong as you say, we push hard for an early settlement.
A limo fetched them on the ramp, just a few feet from where they stepped off the plane. The pilots and Julia stayed behind, tidying up and no doubt making sure the wine was chilled for the next flight.
The Peninsula, French said to the driver.
Yes, sir, Mr. French, he replied.
I'm curious about your ads, French said, turning to Clay as they moved through the congestion of New Jersey. Give me your budget.
It was as if he and Clay had been in business for years. What the hell, Clay thought. Sitting in the back of the limo together, they certainly seemed like partners.
$2 million for advertising, another $2 million for the urinalyses. Here's what we'll do, French said, without the slightest gap in the conversation. Spend all your money on advertising. Get the damn cases, okay? I'll front the money for the urinalyses, all of it, and we'll make Ackerman Labs reimburse us when we settle. That's a normal part of every settlement, to make the company cover all medicals.
The tests are $300 each, Clay said.
You're getting screwed. I'll put some technicians together and we'll do it much cheaper.
Which reminded French of a story, one about the early days of Skinny Bend litigation. He converted four former Greyhound buses into traveling clinics and raced all over the country screening potential clients. Clay listened with fading interest as they crossed the George Washington Bridge. Another story followed. Clay's suite at the Peninsula had a view of Fifth Avenue. Once he was safely locked inside, away from Pat and French, he grabbed the phone and began searching for Max Pace. The third cell phone number found Pace at some undisclosed location. Clay was surprised at how comforting it was to hear Pace's voice. He explained that he was in New York, whom he was with, and why he was there. Pace's first words sealed the deal.
Brilliant, he said. Just brilliant.
You know him?
Everybody in this business knows Patton French, Pace said. I've never had to deal with him, but he's a legend.
Clay gave the terms of the offer from French. Pace quickly caught up and then began thinking ahead. If you refile in Biloxi, Mississippi, Ackerman stock will take another hit, he said. They're under tremendous pressure right now. Pressure from their banks and their shareholders. This is brilliant, Clay. Do it.
Okay, done. And watch the New York Times in the morning. Big story about Dyloft. The first medical report is out. It's devastating. Great.
Dinner was at Montrachet. Not for the food, which was very good, but for the wine list, which was thicker than any other in New York. When the wines had been opened and were breathing, French said,
I called my office. That lawyer in Miami is already on the air with Dyloft ads. He set up two screening clinics and is running them through like cattle. Name's Carlos Hernandez, and he's very, very good.
My people can't answer all the calls, Clay said.
Are we in this together? French said.
Let's go over the deal. At which French whipped out a folded document.
Here's the deal memo, he said, handing it over while he went for the first bottle. It summarizes what we've discussed so far.
Clay read it carefully and signed at the bottom. French between sips signed as well, and the partnership was born.
Let's file the class action in Biloxi tomorrow, French said. I'll do it when I get home. I've got two lawyers working on it right now. As soon as it's filed, you can dismiss yours in D.C. I know the in-house counsel for Ackerman Labs. I think I can talk to him. If the company will negotiate directly with us and bypass their outside counsel, then they can save a bloody fortune and give it to us, and it will greatly expedite matters. If their outside lawyers take charge of the negotiations, it could cost us a half a year in wasted time. The phone was ringing, and it was still dark outside. The clock, when he could finally focus on it, gave the time at 5:45. "Get up," French growled at him, "and open the door." By the time he unlocked it, French was pushing it open and marching past with newspapers and a cup of coffee. "Unbelievable," he said, flinging a copy of the Times on Clay's bed. "You can't sleep all day, son. Read this." He was dressed in hotel garb, the complimentary terry cloth robe and white shower shoes. "It's not 6 yet. I haven't slept past 5 in 30 years. There are too many lawsuits out there." Clay wore nothing but his boxer shorts. He read the story as French gulped coffee and exhibited no sign whatever of a hangover. Some doctors were already pulling the drug. Ackerman Labs offered a rather weak denial, shifting blame as always to greedy trial lawyers, though the company appeared to be hunkering down. No comment from the FDA. There was only one paragraph about the class action filed in D.C. on Monday, and no mention of the young lawyer who'd filed it. Ackerman's stock had tumbled from $42.50 Monday morning to $32.50 at the close on Wednesday.
"Should have shorted the damn thing," French mumbled.
Clay bit his tongue and kept a secret, one of the few he'd held on to in the past 24 hours. "We can read it again on the plane," French said. "Let's get out of here." The stock was at $28 by the time Clay walked into his office and tried to say hello to his weary staff. He went online to a website with the latest market movements and checked it every 15 minutes, counting his gains. Burning money on one front, it was comforting to see some profits on the other. Jonah was the first to stop by.
"We were here until midnight last night," he said. "It's crazy."
"It's about to get crazier. We're doubling the TV ads." Jonah closed the door behind him.
"Clay, look, it's just me and you, right?"
Clay looked around the office and saw no one else.
"What is it?"
"Well, you're a smart guy and all, but do you know what you're doing here? I mean, you're burning money faster than it's ever been burned. What if something goes wrong?"
"You worried?"
"We're all a little worried, okay? This firm is off to a great start. We want to stay and have fun and make money and all that, but what if you're wrong and you go belly up? It's a fair question."
Clay walked around to the edge of his desk and sat on the corner.
"I'll be very honest with you. I think I know what I'm doing, but since I've never done it before, then I can't be certain. It's one huge gamble. If I win, then we all make some serious money. If I lose, then we're still in business. We just won't be rich. If you get the chance, tell the others, okay?"
"I will."
Lunch was a 10-minute sandwich break in the conference room. Jonah had the latest numbers. For the first 3 days, the hotline had fielded 7,100 calls, and the website had averaged 8,000 inquiries per day. Information packets and contracts for legal services had been mailed as quickly as possible, though they were quickly falling behind. Clay authorized Jonah to hire 2 part-time computer assistants. Paulette was given the task of finding 3 or 4 additional paralegals to work in the sweatshop, and Miss Glick was directed to hire as many temporary clerks as necessary to handle the client correspondence. Clay described his meeting with Pat and French and explained their new legal strategy. He showed them copies of the article in the Times. They'd been too busy to notice. "The race is on, folks," he said, trying his best to motivate a weary bunch. "The sharks are coming after our clients."
"We are the sharks," Paulette said.
Ackerman Labs closed the day at $26.25. A paper profit of $1,625,000 if Clay bought now and covered his short sale. He decided to wait. The news of the Biloxi filing would hit in the morning, and it would do nothing but hurt the stock. At midnight, he was sitting at his desk chatting with a gentleman in Seattle who had taken Dyloft for almost a year and was now horrified that he probably had tumors. Clay advised him to get to the doctor as soon as possible for the urinalysis. He gave him the website and promised to mail out an information packet first thing tomorrow. When they hung up, the man was on the verge of tears.
The FDA finally ordered Dyloft off the market. The bad news was, of course, wonderful news to the lawyers, and the frenzy heated up as more and more latecomers piled on.
Pat and French had never seen a mass tort class come together so beautifully. Because he and Clay won the race to the courthouse in Biloxi, their class had been certified first. All other Dyloft plaintiffs wanting in a class action would be forced to join theirs, with the plaintiff's steering committee raking off an additional fee. French's friendly judge had already appointed the five-lawyer committee, French, Clay, Carlos Hernandez from Miami, and two other cronies from New Orleans. In theory, the committee would handle the large and complicated trial against Ackerman Labs. In reality, the five would shuffle paperwork and cover the administrative chore of keeping 50,000 or so clients and their lawyers somewhat organized. French talked every day to the in-house counsel at Ackerman Labs, an embattled old warrior who had tried to retire twice, but the CEO wouldn't allow it. French's message was clear and simple. Let's talk settlement now, without your outside lawyers, because you know you're not going to trial with this drug. Ackerman was beginning to listen. In mid-August, French convened a summit of the Dyloft lawyers at his sprawling ranch near Ketchum, Idaho. He explained to Clay that his attendance was mandatory, as a member of the plaintiff's steering committee, and, just as important, the rest of the boys were quite anxious to meet the young upstart who broke the Dyloft case.
Plus, with these guys, you can't miss a single meeting, else they'll stab you in the back.
I'll be there, Clay promised. Clay's chartered jet was the smallest one at the Ketchum Sun Valley Airport at Freedman, Idaho. As he taxied by Gulf Streams and Challengers, Clay had the ridiculous thought that his jet was inadequate, that he needed a bigger one. Then he laughed at himself. There he was in the leather-lined cabin of a $3 million Lear, and he was debating whether he should get something bigger. At least he could still laugh. What would he be when the laughing stopped? A van was waiting with what appeared to be an imitation cowboy behind the wheel. Fortunately, the driver was not much of a talker, and Clay enjoyed the 45-minute ride in silence. They twisted upward on roads that became narrower. Not surprisingly, Patton's spread was postcard perfect and very new. The house was a lodge with enough wings and levels to host a good-sized law firm. Another cowboy took Clay's bag. "Mr. French is waiting on the deck out back," he said, as if Clay had been there many times. Switzerland was the topic when Clay found them. Which secluded ski resort they preferred. He listened for a second as he approached. The other four members of the plaintiff's steering committee were lounging in chairs, facing the mountains, smoking dark cigars and working on drinks. When they realized Clay was present, they hopped to attention as if the judge had entered the courtroom. In the first 3 minutes of excited conversation, he was called brilliant, shrewd, gutsy, and his favorite, a visionary.
"You gotta tell us how you found Dyloft," Carlos Hernandez said.
"He won't tell," French said as he mixed some vile concoction for Clay to drink.
"Come on," said Wes Salisbury. Within just a few minutes, Clay would learn that Wes had made about a $500 million on the tobacco settlement 3 years earlier.
"I'm sworn to silence," Clay said.
The other lawyer from New Orleans was Damon Didier, one of the speakers at a session Clay had attended during his Circle of Barristers weekend. Didier was stone-faced and steely-eyed, and Clay remembered wondering how this guy could ever connect with a jury. Didier, he found out soon enough, had made a mint when a riverboat packed with fraternity boys sunk into Lake Pontchartrain. Such misery. A butler in a Roy Rogers-style shirt informed Mr. French that dinner would be served in an hour. They moved downstairs to a game room with pool tables and big screens. A dozen or so white men were drinking and talking, and some were holding pool cues. "The rest of the conspiracy," Hernandez whispered to Clay. Patton introduced him to the group. The names, faces, and hometowns quickly blurred. They all paid homage to this brilliant young litigator who'd shocked them with his daring assault on Dyloft. When the admiration was finally over, French said there were a few things to discuss before dinner. Everyone crowded around their host, who lived for moments like this. He began,
"As you know, I've spent a lot of time with Wicks, the in-house guy at Ackerman Labs. Bottom line is they're going to settle, and do it quickly. They're getting hit from every direction, and they want this to go away as soon as possible. Their stock is so low now they're afraid of a takeover. What they don't want is protracted litigation on many fronts, with verdicts landing everywhere.
Neither do they want to fork over tens of millions for defense.
Poor guys, someone said. Businessweek mentioned bankruptcy, someone else said. Have they used that threat?
Not yet. And I don't expect them to. Ackerman has far too many assets. But we need to determine two things. First, how many potential plaintiffs are out there? Second, the value of each case.
Let's add them up, drawled someone from Texas. I got 1,000.
I have 1,800, French said.
Carlos?
2,000, Hernandez said as he began taking notes. Wes?
900.
A lawyer from Topeka had 600, the lowest. 2,000 was the highest until French saved the best for last.
Clay, he said, and everyone listened intently.
3,200, Clay said, managing a grim poker face. His newly found brethren, however, were quite pleased. Or at least they appeared to be.
That's 24,000, Carlos said, doing the quick math.
We can safely double that, French insisted, which gets close to 50, the number Ackerman has pegged. 50,000 into 2 billion is 40,000 bucks per case. Not a bad starting place.
Clay did some quick math of his own. $40,000 times his 3,200 cases came to something over $120 million. And one-third of that, well, his brain froze and his knees went weak.
Dinner was a fiasco. They fought over everything, documents, whether or not to press for a trial while ignoring a quick settlement, turf, false advertising, how to round up the other cases, expenses, fees. Clay's stomach was in knots and he never said a word. The rest seemed to enjoy their food immensely while carrying on two or three arguments simultaneously.
Experience, Clay told himself. After the longest dinner of Clay's life, French led them downstairs, back to the billiards room where the cognac and more cigars were waiting. Those who had been swearing at each other for 3 hours were now drinking and laughing like fraternity brothers. At the first opportunity, Clay sneaked away and, after considerable effort, found his room.
The Barry and Harry show was scheduled for 10 a.m. Saturday morning, time for everyone to sleep off the hangovers and choke down a heavy breakfast. French had made available trout fishing and skeet shooting, neither of which drew a single lawyer. Barry and Harry had a company in New York that did nothing but analyze the finances of target companies. They had sources and contacts and spies and a reputation for peeling back the skin and finding the real truth. French had flown them in for a one-hour presentation.
"Costs us $200,000, he whispered proudly to Clay. "And we'll make Ackerman Labs reimburse us. Imagine that."
Their routine was a tag team. Barry doing the graphics, Harry with the pointer, two professors at the lectern. Both stood at the front of the small theater, one level below the billiards room. The lawyers, for once, were silent. The cash flow analysis was dense and took both Harry and Barry talking at once to complete. Numbers and percentages spewed forth and soon drowned everyone else in the room. Barry and Harry were also lawyers, and so were quite adept at assessing a company's likely response to a mass tort disaster like Dyloft. It would be wise for Ackerman to settle quickly, in stages.
A pancake settlement, Harry said.
Clay was certain that he was the only person in the room who had no idea what a pancake settlement was.
Stage one would be $2 billion for all level one plaintiffs, Harry continued, mercifully laying out the elements of such a plan. We think they might do this within 90 days, Barry added. Stage two would be $500 million for level two plaintiffs, those with malignancy who don't die. And stage three would be left open for 5 years to cover the death cases, Barry said.
We think Ackerman can pay around $2.5 to $3 billion over the next year, then another $500 million over 5 years.
Anything beyond that and you could be looking at a Chapter 11, said Barry.
Which is not advisable for this company. Too many banks have too many priority liens, and a bankruptcy would seriously choke off the flow of money. It would take from 3 to 5 years to get a decent settlement, Harry concluded.
Of course, the lawyers wanted to argue for a while. Vincent from Pittsburgh was especially determined to impress the rest with his financial acumen, but Harry and Barry soon put him back in his place. After an hour, they left to go fishing. French took their place at the front of the room. All arguments had been completed. The fighting had stopped. It was time to agree on a plan. Step one was to round up the other cases. Every man for himself. No holds barred.
Since they accounted for half of the total, there were still plenty of Dyloft plaintiffs out there. Let's find them. Search out the small-time lawyers with only 20 or 30 cases. Bring them into the fold. Do whatever it takes to get the cases. Step two would be a settlement conference with Ackerman Labs in 60 days. The plaintiff's steering committee would schedule it and send notices. Step three would be an all-out effort to keep everyone in the class. Strength in numbers. Those who opted out of the class and wanted to have their own trial would not have access to the deadly documents. It was as simple as that. Hardball, but it was litigation. Every lawyer in the room objected to some part of the plan, but the alliance held. Dyloft looked as if it would be the quickest settlement in mass tort history, and the lawyers were smelling the money. The young firm's next reorganization occurred in the same chaotic fashion as the previous ones, and for the same reasons. Too many new clients, too much new paperwork, not enough manpower, an unclear chain of command, and a very uncertain management style because no one at the top had ever managed before, maybe with the exception of Miss Glick. 3 days after Clay returned from Ketchum, Paulette and Jonah confronted him in his office with a long list of urgent problems. Mutiny was in the air. Nerves were frayed, and the fatigue made bad matters worse. According to the best estimate, the firm now had 3,320 Dyloft cases, and since the cases were brand new, they all needed immediate attention. "These clients are scared," Paulette said. "They're scared because they have these tumors. They're scared because Dyloft is all over the press. Hell, they're scared because we've scared the hell out of them." "They want to be talked to," Jonah said. "And they want a lawyer on the other end of the phone, not some frantic paralegal on an assembly line. I'm afraid we'll be losing clients real soon." "We're not going to lose clients," Clay said, thinking of all those nice sharks he just met out in Idaho and how happy they'd be to pick up his disgruntled clients. "How many lawyers do we need?" Paulette cast a weary look at Jonah. The two had no answer. 10, she said. "At least 10, Jonah said. 10 for now, right now, and maybe more later." "We're cranking up the advertising," Clay said. There was a long, weary pause as Jonah and Paulette absorbed this. Jonah had the rather unusual idea of hiring a doctor for 1 year, someone to coordinate the tests and medical evidence. "We can get one fresh out of school for $100,000 a year," he said. "He wouldn't have much experience, but who cares? He's not doing surgery, just paperwork." "Get it done," Clay said. Next on Jonah's list was a Dyloft newsletter for those who didn't use the internet. Paulette nodded. "We need one full-time person editing and mailing a newsletter," she said. "Can you find someone?" Clay asked. "I suppose so." "Then do it." She looked at Jonah, as if whatever needed to be said should come from him. Jonah tossed a legal pad on the desk and cracked his knuckles. "Clay, we're spending huge amounts of money here," he said. "Are you sure you know what you're doing?" "No, but I think so. Just trust me, okay? We're about to make some serious money. To get there, though, we gotta spend some cash." "And you have the cash?" Paulette asked.
"Yep."
Pace wanted a late drink in a bar in Georgetown, within walking distance of Clay's townhouse. He was in and out of the city, very vague, as always, about where he'd been and what fire he happened to be fighting. Clay, with the flair of a fledgling trial lawyer, gave a colorful description of his trip to French's ranch and the gang of thieves he'd met there. He had no hesitation in giving Pace the details because Pace knew more than anyone. Into the second beer, Pace asked, "You sold Ackerman short, right?" He glanced around, but no one was listening. It was a college bar on a slow night. 100,000 shares at $42.50, Clay said proudly. "Ackerman closed today at 23. "I know, I do the math every day." "It's time to cover the short and buy it back, like first thing tomorrow morning."
"Something's coming?"
"Yes, and while you're at it, buy all you can at 23, then hang on for the ride."
"Where might the ride be headed?"
"It'll double." 6 hours later, Clay was at the office, before sunrise, trying to prepare for another day of pure frenzy, and also anxious for the markets to open. His list of things to do ran for 2 pages, almost all of it involving the enormous task of immediately hiring 10 new lawyers and finding workspace to house some of them. It looked hopeless, but he had no choice.
He called a realtor at 7:30 and yanked him out of the shower. At 8:30, he had a 10-minute interview with a freshly fired young lawyer named Oscar Mulrooney. The poor guy had been a star student at Yale, then highly recruited, then merged out of a job when a mega firm imploded. He'd also been married for 2 months and was desperate for work. Clay hired him on the spot for $75,000 a year. Mulrooney had four friends, also from Yale, who were also on the streets looking for work in a soft economy. Go get 'em. At 10 a.m., Clay called his broker and covered his Ackerman short sale, making a profit of $1.9 million and some change. In the same call, he took the entire profit and bought another 200,000 shares at $23, using his margin and some account credit. Online, he watched the market all morning. Nothing changed. Oscar Mulrooney was back at noon with his friends, all as eager as Boy Scouts. Clay hired the others, then gave them the task of renting their furniture, hooking up their phones, doing everything necessary to begin their new careers as low-level mass tort lawyers. It was up to Oscar to hire five more lawyers who would have to find their own office space, etc. The Yale branch was born. At 5 p.m. Eastern Time, Philo Products announced it would buy the outstanding common stock of Ackerman Labs for $50 a share, a merger with a price tag of $14 billion. Clay watched the drama on the big screen in his conference room, alone because everyone else was answering the damn telephones. Was Philo the maker of Tarvan? Pace's client? Had Clay been manipulated to bring about a $14 billion takeover? And most troubling, what did it all mean for the future of Ackerman Labs and Dyloft? Patton French called from his airplane, somewhere between Florida and Texas. He'd already talked with Barry and Harry in New York, and they were not worried about the Philo takeover. Ackerman owns 12 million shares of its own stock, French said. Now worth at least $50 a share, but maybe more before the dust settles. The company just picked up $600 million in equity alone. Plus, the government has to approve the merger, and they typically want the litigation cleaned up before saying yes. Also, Philo is notorious for avoiding courtrooms. They settle fast and quiet. Sounds like Tarvan, Clay thought. Overall, it's good news, French said, with a fax buzzing in the background. Clay could see him pacing up and down in his Gulfstream. I'll keep you posted. Rex Crittle wanted to scold, to be reassured, to lecture, to educate. But his client sitting across the desk seemed completely unshaken by the figures. Your firm is 6 months old, Crittle said, peering over his reading glasses with a pile of reports in front of him. Your overhead began at an impressive $75,000 a month. Three lawyers, one paralegal, a secretary, serious rent, nice digs. Now it's $500,000 a month and growing every day. You gotta spend it to make it, Clay said, sipping coffee and enjoying his accountant's discomfort. That was the sign of a good bean counter, one who lost more sleep over the expenses than the client himself. But you're not making it, Crittle said cautiously. No revenue in the past 3 months. It's been a good year. Oh, yes, $15 million in fees makes for a splendid year. Problem is, it's evaporating. You spent $14,000 last month chartering jets. Now that you mention it, I'm thinking about buying one. I'll need you to crunch the numbers. I'm crunching them right now. You can't justify one. That's not the issue. The issue is whether or not I can afford one. Any idea how much one might cost? 40, 45 million for a Gulfstream? I hate to break the news, Clay, but you don't have 40 million. You're right. I think I'll just lease one.
Crittle removed his reading glasses and massaged his long, skinny nose, as if a severe headache was developing there.
Look, Clay, I'm just your accountant, but I'm not sure if there's anyone else who is telling you to slow down. Take it easy, pal. You've made a fortune. Enjoy it. You don't need a big firm with so many lawyers. You don't need jets. What's next, a yacht?
Yes.
You're serious?
Yes.
I thought you hated boats.
I do. It's for my father. Can I depreciate it?
No.
Bet I can.
How?
I'll charter it when I'm not using it. When Crittle was finished with his nose, he replaced his glasses and said,
It's your money, pal.
They met in New York City, on neutral ground, in the dingy ballroom of an old hotel near Central Park, the last place anyone would expect such an important gathering to take place. On one side of the table sat the Dyloft Plaintiff Steering Committee, five of them, including young Clay Carter, who felt quite out of place, and behind them were all manner of assistants and associates and gophers employed by Mr. Patton French.
Across the table was the Ackerman team, headed by Cal Wicks, a distinguished veteran who was flanked by an equal number of supporters. 1 week earlier, the government had approved the merger with Philo Products at $53 a share, which for Clay meant another profit, somewhere around $6 million. He'd buried half of it offshore, never to be touched, so the venerable company founded by the Ackerman brothers a century earlier was about to be consumed by Philo, a company with barely half its annual revenues but a lot less debt and a much brighter management. Pat and French may have had plenty of backup, but he needed none. He took charge of the first session and soon everyone else shut up, with the exception of Wicks, who spoke only when necessary. They spent the morning nailing down the number of cases out there. Numbers poured forth, and Clay was soon bored with it all. The only number that mattered to him was 5,380, his Dyloft share. He still had more than any single lawyer, though French himself had closed the gap brilliantly and had just over 5,000. After 3 hours of nonstop statistics, they agreed on a one-hour lunch. The plaintiff's committee went upstairs to a suite where they ate sandwiches and drank only water. French was soon on the phone, talking and yelling at the same time. Wes Salisbury wanted some fresh air and invited Clay for a quick walk around the block. They strolled up Fifth Avenue, across from the park. It was mid-November, the air chilly and light, the leaves blowing across the street, a great time to be in the city.
"I love to come here and I love to leave," Salisbury said. "Right now it's 85 in New Orleans, humidity still at 90.
Clay just listened. He was too preoccupied with the excitement of the moment. The settlement that was only hours away, the enormous fees, the complete freedom of being young and single and so wealthy.
"How old are you, Clay?" Wes was saying.
31.
"Are you familiar with the lead paint cases?"
"Not really.
They're not as famous as the drug cases, but pretty damn lucrative. I started the rage about 10 years ago. Our clients are schools, churches, hospitals, commercial buildings, all with layers of lead paint on the walls. Very dangerous stuff. We've sued the paint manufacturers, settled with a few. A couple of billion so far. Anyway, during discovery against one company, I found out about another nice little mass tort that you might want to look at. I can't handle it because of some conflicts."
"I'm listening."
"The company is in Reedsburg, Pennsylvania, and it makes the mortar used by bricklayers in new home construction. Pretty low-tech stuff, but a potential gold mine. Seems they're having problems with their mortar. A bad batch. After about 3 years, it begins to crumble. When the mortar breaks down, the bricks start falling. It's confined to the Baltimore area, probably about 2,000 homes, and it's just beginning to get noticed."
"What are the damages?"
"It costs roughly $15,000 to fix each house."
$15,000 times 2,000 houses, a one-third contract and the lawyer's fees equaled $10 million. Clay was getting quick with his figures.
"The proof will be easy," Salisbury said. "The company knows it has exposure. Settlement should not be a problem."
"I'd like to look at it."
"I'll send you the file, but you have to protect my confidence."
"You get a piece?"
"No. It's my payback for Dyloft. And, of course, if you get the chance to return the favor someday, then it will be appreciated." "That's how some of us work, Clay. The mass tort brotherhood is full of throat cutters and egomaniacs, but a few of us try to take care of each other."
Late in the afternoon, Ackerman Labs agreed to a minimum of $62,000 for each of the Group 1 Dyloft plaintiffs. Those with benign tumors that could be removed with a fairly simple surgical procedure, the cost of which would also be borne by the company. Approximately 40,000 plaintiffs were in this class, and the money would be available immediately. Much of the haggling that followed involved the method to be used in qualifying for the settlement. A ferocious fight erupted when the issue of attorney's fees was thrown on the table. Like most of the other lawyers, Clay had a contingency contract giving him one-third of any recovery. But in such settlements, that percentage was normally reduced. A very complicated formula was used and argued about, with French being unduly aggressive. It was, after all, his money. Ackerman eventually agreed on the figure of 28% for Group 1 fees. Group 2 plaintiffs were those with malignant tumors, and since their treatments would take months or years, the settlement was left open. No cap was placed on these damages. Evidence, according to Barry and Harry, that Philo Products was somewhere in the background, propping up Ackerman with some extra cash.
The attorneys would get 25% in Group 2, though Clay had no idea why. French was crunching numbers too fast for anyone. Group 3 plaintiffs were those from Group 2 who would die because of Dyloft. Since there had been no deaths so far, this class was also left open. The fees were capped at 22%. They adjourned at 7 with the plan to meet the next day to nail down the details for Groups 2 and 3. On the elevator down, French handed him a printout.
"Not a bad day's work," he said with a smile.
It was a summary of Clay's cases and anticipated fees, including a 7% add-on for his role on the plaintiff steering committee. His expected gross fees from Group 1 alone were $106 million. When he was finally alone, he stood in front of the window in his room and gazed into the dusk settling over Central Park. Clearly, Tarvan had not braced him for the shock of instant riches. He was numb, speechless, frozen in the window forever as random thoughts raced in and out of his severely overloaded brain. He drank 2 straight whiskeys from the minibar with absolutely no effect. Still at the window, he called Paulette, who snatched the phone after half a ring. "Talk to me," she said when she recognized his voice.
"Round 1 is over," he said.
"Don't beat around the bush."
"You just made 10 million bucks," he said, the words coming from his mouth, but in a voice that belonged to someone else.
"Don't lie to me, Clay," her words trailed off.
"It's true. I'm not lying." There was a pause as she began to cry. He backpedaled and sat on the edge of the bed, and for a moment felt like a good cry himself.
"Oh, my God," she managed to say twice.
"I've got to call the others," Clay said. Jonah was still at the office. He began yelling into the phone, then threw it down to go fetch Rodney. Clay heard them talking in the background. A door slammed. Rodney picked up the phone and said,
"I'm listening."
"Your share is 10 million," Clay said for the third time, playing Santa Claus as he would never play it again.
"Mercy, mercy, mercy," Rodney was saying.
Jonah was screaming something in the background.
"Hard to believe," Clay said.
For a moment, he held the image of Rodney sitting at his old desk at OPD, files and papers everywhere, photos of his wife and kids pinned to the wall, a fine man working hard for very low pay. What would he tell his wife when he called home in a few minutes? When he'd finished delivering the news, Clay sat on the bed for a long time, sad with the realization that there was no one else to call. Suddenly he clenched his jaws and dialed Rebecca's number. It was a Wednesday, a slow night at the country club. Surely she was at her apartment. After 3 rings, she said,
"Hello?"
And the sound of her voice made him weak.
"Hey, it's Clay,"
he said, trying to sound casual. Not a word in 6 months, but the ice was immediately broken.
"Hello, stranger," she said, cordial.
"How are you?"
"Fine, busy as always. You?"
"About the same. I'm in New York, settling some cases."
"I hear things are going well for you."
An understatement.
"Not bad. I can't complain. How's your job?"
"I have 6 more days."
"You're quitting?"
"Yes, there's a wedding, you know."
"So I heard. When is it?"
"December 20th. I haven't received an invitation."
"Well, I didn't send you one. Didn't think you'd want to come."
"Probably not. Are you sure you want to get married?"
"Let's talk about something else."
"Don't do it, Rebecca. Your parents will eat him alive. Plus your kids will look like him, a bunch of little worms." The line went dead. He stretched out on the bed and stared at the ceiling, still hearing her voice. Hit hard with the realization of just how